comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted that you're here. I'm delighted to be here as well. We're here because you have a right to know and because you matter. This is Friday. That means it's weekend eve, and that's a good time for most folks. You know, by the time you get to Friday, almost everybody has pretty much had enough, and they're ready for a little break, and I hope you have a great break. I hope the weekend is a great weekend for you, and whatever it is you have planned to do for the weekend, make sure you do it safely. We don't want to lose anybody between now and Monday, and as a matter of fact, after Monday, we don't want to lose anybody either, so just keep it safe. We're going to be talking tonight with Brian Forrester. Brian Forrester is, he's been with us before, and he is the guy from South America, our broadcast from South America. He lives there, works there, and he's the guy that showed us the skull, the elongated skull. And he's got some update news on what's happening with that. You know, those are pretty interesting. I don't know if you are familiar with those. If you're not, then just go on the internet, do a search for elongated skull, and then hit images. And when you do that, you're going to see a whole bunch of images of what looks like human skulls, except they, instead of having the normal shape, they're elongated. And they're quite a mystery, big mystery. Who are they? Where did they come from? Are they actually human? Or are they some alien species? Or are they a different branch of the human race? Maybe not in our genealogy at all. Maybe a completely separate branch. Well, the only way to find out is to do some testing, you know. So we'll be talking with Brian about that in just a moment when we come back from break. And we're delighted to have him with us again. It is where he is located 1 hour later than it is where I am located. So he's staying up a little bit later tonight, and we certainly appreciate that. If you are not yet subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, please do so. It's free. We don't get anything out of it by you subscribing, but you're missing a lot by not subscribing. Now, we've been publishing that newsletter. It's called The K-Files, and we've been publishing that since this show has been in existence back in 2000 when we started in Kosovo. And we've got people that are still subscribed from way back then. So it must be pretty good. And if you're not getting it, you got to ask yourself the question, where's the genius in that? So just get over to the website, and where you see K-Files, click it and subscribe. Now, you're going to get an automatic email, and it's got a link in it for you to activate your subscription. Be sure you click that, and then you're good to go, and you won't be sitting in the dark any longer. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show. This is The Kevin Smith, and I will be your host for the whole evening. So if you don't like me, this is going to be miserable for you. But if you do, this is going to be wonderful. It's going to be great for everybody because Brian Forster is my guest, and this guy is just interesting. He's got lots of interesting information, and it's a delight to have him back with us. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Brian, what city or town are you located in right now?
Actually, I just arrived in Paracas about 2 hours ago, which is where the elongated skulls are more prolific than anywhere else on the planet.
Now, you don't live in Caracas, right? Paracas, right?
Actually, I do. I spend part of part time in Paracas and part time in Cusco.
In Cusco, yeah. Now, you work with a museum there in Paracas, do you not? Or is it in Cusco?
Oh, sorry, but actually, since our last interview, I'm associated with the Paracas History Museum and also a small museum up near Cusco as well. So both museums are very interesting because both have elongated skulls, and the one in near Cusco actually has elongated skeletons.
Skeletons.
Like full skeletons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about those first, just briefly. When you say an elongated skeleton, what do you mean? It's a giant?
In this case, it's a baby that died at less than a year old, but the size of the skull is basically the size of its chest. And so this was a child probably about a year old when it died, but the news is that I will have access in the coming weeks or months to supposedly 7-foot-tall elongated skull skeletons.
And that's up near Cusco where that will be?
Yeah, it's about an hour's drive from Cusco.
Uh-huh. Okay, now, you said that in Paracas, that's where the elongated skulls proliferate, right?
Yeah, it's actually the one place on the planet where there are more elongated skulls than probably anywhere else on Earth due to the fact that it's a very desert climate, and so it's been easy for the skulls and skeletons to be preserved. And what we do know for sure is most are at least 2,000 years old.
So Paracas is located, is that near Chile?
It's actually south of the capital city of Lima by about 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about one-third of the way up the country from the border of Chile.
Okay. All right. So these elongated skulls that you have there in Paracas, how do they compare with the ones you've got at the other museum up near Cusco? I mean, do they look the same, or are there differences?
Well, the thing is, because there are so many that have been found at Paracas and the surrounding area, there are 5 different shapes of elongated skull, whereas up in Cusco, in the Cusco area, it's more or less one kind of shape. And the ones up around Cusco are literally like those seen on the old Saturday Night Live with Dan Aykroyd. They are cone heads, whereas in Paracas there are variations on that. Some of them are not as much cone head like. Some of them are actually almost like compressed skulls, but they are so different from a normal human skull that has, you know, has caused my interest over the last 2 years.
Now, when you say compressed, what do we mean?
Well, basically, instead of being conehead as in vertical, they seem to be the skull has been pushed down and flattened on top, and in some cases, it's more like a lateral elongation. It's more like a sideways elongation from front to back rather than from bottom to top.
Now, would that be the ones that I have seen some where the skull is shaped very similar to the shape of the depictions we see of gray aliens? Would it be that shape?
To some degree, but actually the elongated cone head type seem to be that way as well. But yeah, I would say the compressed ones are more like the typical gray depictions. That's right.
You've been associated with this and dealing with these skulls. Not just these skulls. You're involved in a lot of other things, but you've been around this and researching it and been affiliated with this work for quite some time. Any guess as to whether they are human or off-world?
Well, that's the big question. And the thing is, because there are different shapes and sizes, I'm trying to categorize them. And fortunately, we are in the process of DNA testing right now. I was doing work in the past with Lloyd Pye of the Star Child Project. His geneticist, who studied the and is studying the Star Child, has been studying the DNA of some of the Paracas skulls, but it's been a very long process, and so we have a different team in the United States which is actively just starting work now. And in fact, about 20 minutes ago I was having dinner with two gentlemen, and they are financing the whole operation. So that's absolute breaking news for your you and your listeners, because that's been the problem, is the cost of having DNA analysis done. But as of 20 minutes ago, we now have the green light to find out in specific individuals, to study them and to see what commonalities they have with human beings of the time period of about 2,000 years ago, and to see what genetic areas may be not only strange, but possibly either not Homo sapiens sapiens, but, you know, quite possibly something even more intriguing, as in, I dare to say alien, but you never know. We won't know
that's
until the...
Right. Yeah, you know, that's one possibility. Another possibility is that they are completely terrestrial, but just a different branch of the human family. This always engenders a great deal of debate when I bring this up. But Neanderthals, some of the scientists say, yes, they're human, but a completely different branch and not part of our ancestry. Others say they are part of our ancestry. But regardless, so there are some that say they're a different branch. And then you've got the hobbits, as they were called, that were discovered over on an island of Indonesia. And they say that's a completely separate branch as well. Human, but a different branch. And so that's a possibility, isn't it, that these elongated skulls may be entirely terrestrial and may be human, but not part of our family.
Well, that's very true. And there was a German study done 2 years ago that I have access to. And what it found out is that there's very little genetic similarity between people of the highlands of Peru, which is where most people think the great cultures came from, as in the Inca, and the people of the coast of Peru. So what I'm trying to look at as well is the possibility that these beings are not wholly ancestrally Peruvian, but they may have genetic matter or ancestry from elsewhere on the planet. One factor to bring in is that these people were solely the nobility, the royal class of people, and many of them had auburn-colored hair. They were not black-haired like a typical Native American person.
So how do we know that they were the nobility?
Actually, it's quite simple, because the finest pottery in Peru in ancient times was the possession of those of nobility, as in the most beautiful painted and glazed pottery and other utensils and things would be buried with the individual, and it's only amongst the elongated skulls that we find the finest of this. Common people in the area who were buried at the same time would be buried with unglazed pots or nothing, but it's the great the great treasures or royal treasures which are always found with elongated skulls. So that meant definitely that they were of the high spiritual and chiefly classes.
What do, are you familiar with any of the legends and the folklore of the area about these people? Or does any folklore exist about them?
Actually, very much so. There's an ancient race called the Viracocha, and they were spoken of as being the great teachers who lived long before the Inca and were responsible, perhaps, for example, building the great megalithic stone places such as Tiwanaku in Bolivia, Pumapunku, and some of the finest constructions around Cusco, which are attributed to the Inca but clearly were not built by the Inca because they show signs of ancient high technology at work.
Okay, so and you said they're called the Viracocha.
Yeah.
And so what is the legend say about the Viracocha? I mean, do they say that they came from the stars, or do the legends say that they came from across the sea, or what does it say?
Well, the most common stories say that they came from the heavens, that they were sent by the Creator to the planet in order to be great teachers. They were very tall people, very light-skinned people. They had red hair, and they had beards, and some of them say that they had blue or green eyes. And to say light skin doesn't necessarily mean white, but they were light skinned as compared to the native people. And they were great teachers who came and taught all of the refined arts of civilization, like agriculture, metallurgy, the different sciences. And then after a period of time, they chose to depart, and they went northwest to the coast and disappeared, never to come back again.
And does the legend go into any detail about why they decided to depart?
Yeah, basically it was the fact that they it's felt that they had taught as much as they could, and that in fact a lot of the local people didn't appreciate having these great teachers there. They were treated to some degree with ridicule and abuse, and so they chose to leave to possibly to other parts of the world. And in fact, the legends or stories of Kukulkan in Central America are very, very similar. They could have been the same people, and also amongst the Aztec. The term at the moment, or the name, escapes my mind, but there were three major stories in three major cultural areas of the Central and Southern America area, where you have the Viracochas, Kukulkan, and it's Quetzalcoatl.
Oh yeah,
and they were all called the feathered serpents.
The feathered serpents. See, I've heard that applied to Quetzalcoatl. But I didn't know that that was applied to these other guys. But, all right, so, and they were supposed to be very tall. What are we, talking 7, 8, 10, 12 feet tall, taller?
Well, that's the question that I'm pursuing at the moment. What I do know is that it seems like the Paracas people 2,000 years ago averaged about 6 feet. That's men and women. But I have heard eyewitness accounts, and I will be able to actually see this one location within the coming weeks or months of where 7-foot-tall skeletons have been found.
Now, have these been found recently, or is this something that was found a long time ago and put on hold?
Actually, they were found, I believe, in June or July, and they've been kept on hold at the moment because the man who owns the land is very ill. He's actually from the highlands of Peru, but he's been in hospital in Lima ever since then, and my friend Senior Renato of this small museum near Cusco, he's been trying to get access, but he needs written permission from this old gentleman, and we're still waiting word of his health condition, but we're hoping that within the weeks or months to come that we will have access to be able to not only inspect but also extract these relative giants and take them to the museum for investigation.
We have heard stories out of South America, and I cannot remember honestly which country, but I think it was either Peru or Ecuador, or frankly, this one could even be from Mexico. But it's from Klaus Donner, and he was shown pieces of skeleton, and was given a piece of the skeleton to take for testing. He took it back to Vienna, and the forensics people there said, well, tell you what, that's a human heel bone. However, it's 5 times the normal size, and this individual would have been about 21 feet tall. And he shows the picture of that heel bone, and you know, have you run into stories about real giants like that?
Well, actually, I did meet Klaus in May in England at a megalithomania conference, and I did talk to him quite a lot about different things. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to follow the way that a forensic scientist would approach this. Mm-hmm. And according to what I've heard, the only bone in the body which you can use to make a good approximation of total height is the femur, which is the main bone in the leg. Mm-hmm. If you use something like a heel bone or a toe or a finger, you're not going to be able to calculate that accurately.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we'll pick up there when we come back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, Brian Forrester, who's joining us from Paracas in Peru. And we're talking about his work with these elongated skulls and soon with the full skeletons. Brian, I want to go back to the museum for just a moment that you're affiliated with. The History Museum in Paracas. Tell us a little bit about that museum and what do you do there?
Well, it's a private museum. It's the collection of Senior Juan Navarro. He's been a resident of the area since he was born. He's 78 years old, and he has collected hundreds of artifacts from many different cultures who lived in the area, the Inca being the most famous, going back to the Paracas 2,000 years ago and even farther back. He has world-class examples of these different artifacts. And his museum is private. It's solely financed by people who visit. And about a year ago, he accepted me as his associate. So I'm kind of the assistant director. And my main job has been to promote the museum internationally. And also, because there are more than 35 elongated skulls in the museum, I've been able to use them to do analysis of who these people were, where they lived, where they died, and all that sort of thing. And now we're getting into the actual DNA analysis of who they were.
All right. Without the DNA analysis, have you come to some conclusion about who these people were?
Well, the mysterious thing about them is the fact that they're not related to any other people. According to this German study that I have in the area, and especially not from the highlands of Peru, the fact that they have this auburn red hair is quite mysterious. And there are other physical characteristics of the skulls, which I've had a number of different doctors from different countries, nurses, and dentists look at, and they're all quite bewildered by these different characteristics. For example, there are two little holes in the back of the skull, which are very curious because they seem to be for blood and nerve flow. It's as if nature has created these two little holes in order to help feed these, in some cases, overly large skulls with nourishment. Also, the jaws are very massive. There are signs of genetic tooth differences between them and normal humans, and various other factors. And because some of the skulls are broken, we're able to look inside of the cranial cavity, and what we can see is that the shape of their brains was different, and the brain filled the entire cavity, because some people have stated that these skulls have totally been cranially deformed as a ritual. And so the largeness of some of them, some people have said that the interior, that there would be air pockets or spaces, and that's not the case. We can see where the veins of the brain have touched the surface throughout the interior, and it's totally coherent. There are no blank spots. So whatever brains they did have filled the entire cranial space.
Have you found any that have a double row of teeth?
No, that I haven't found. We found dental problems, not due to diet, but they seem to be genetically missing molars.
Hmm. So all of them are missing the molars?
Almost all of them. It depends on what graveyard they're from, because different classes seem to have been buried in different graveyards at different times. There are two specimens which are from probably the most famous of the royal cemeteries, and they have absolutely perfect teeth. The one thing which is different or differentiates them from normal people is the fact that they don't have canine teeth.
Hmm. Now, and it's just the ones from this cemetery that do not have the canine teeth?
No, actually, all of them seem to be missing the at least predominant canines.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just these two have perfect sets of teeth, complete. And the other ones seem to definitely be genetically missing molars because there are no pockets in the jaw. You know, like the teeth wouldn't have fallen out at some point. There simply is no space where the tooth or teeth would have been.
Well, that certainly sounds like something that differentiates them from Homo sapiens. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, the only other example I've heard of is that the elongated skull is something which was global at one time, averaging about 2,000 years ago. but there are examples that have been found in Iraq dating back, I believe, 4,000 years ago, and they as well seem to have had this genetic trait of completely missing certain molar teeth.
You've had scientists that have visited and have viewed these skulls, and you made mention of some doctors and various other medical professionals that have viewed these skulls. What are some of the things that they say? You told us about the two little holes in the back of the skull, but what are some of the other things that they say that astound them about these skulls?
Well, probably the most obvious thing is that in every living human being, present day as well as in the past, is we have three major bone plates. One is called the frontal, which is your forehead, and then the other two are called the parietals, and they're the ones that form the more or less the top and back of the skull. And those three plates have what are called sutures, which are lines which divide those three plates. And in a baby, you know, when a baby's born, a baby's skull is mainly cartilage, which then calcifies and becomes hard. And that's why there's the so-called soft spot on the top of a baby's head. So everybody has these three major plates, but we have five skulls in Paracas, and I was at actually a nearby museum at ICA looking at some other ones today, and we have five, and ICA has two, which only have two cranial plates. There's only a frontal plate and one parietal plate, and that is the main smoking gun that the doctors and nurses and dentists who have looked at them are all astonished about. They look at that and say, that's not possible. A child can't be born with two cranial plates. It has to have three, otherwise it would be very difficult for the child to come out of a mother's body.
Well then, you know, have you ever heard that nature builds things for function, and form follows function?
Always.
Well, that may be why these are cone heads, because a human baby, basically the head is spongy and squishy and can change shape as it's being born. But if these cone heads or elongated skulls do not have the three plates, maybe the purpose for the cone head, the cone shape, is so they can be born. Maybe that makes it possible.
Well, that's a good point. And also the thing is, what will be good about getting hold of full skeletons is to look at the female pelvis to see if the pelvis area of the elongated skulled people is different than a normal person, because as you said, and what is, you know, kind of obvious is that due to the shape of these skulls, the pelvis would have to be of a different shape in order to be able to accommodate that design coming out of the mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, have you had any preliminary statements about the DNA of these elongated skulled people? Or maybe it's too early yet, but have you had any preliminary statements about what they have found or expect to find? Or has it even started yet?
Well, the first tests that were done, thanks to Lloyd Pye and his geneticist studying the star child, is that he was fascinated enough by the preliminary results that he has decided to volunteer his efforts, his very expensive machinery, to continue with it. But again, because he was doing it for free, it's a very long process. He can only do it if and when he has free time. But the new DNA specialists that we have in the U.S. who are doing it not for free, but based on paying for the use of the equipment, they're excited enough that they're going to go full on with the testing, starting more or less now, and we should get preliminary results within a month or two. And after we get preliminary results, then we can go forward. But the main geneticist, who is an MD, has said simply based on the shape of a few very specific elongated skulls, she said there is no way that these are normal humans. There's no way that the skulls have been shaped through ritual, and she suspects that these beings are either a different class or subspecies of human, but she will conjecture mildly towards the fact that they may be hybrids of humans and some other life form.
Maybe hybrids. So, you know what that ignites? That ignites the discussion that all the people that talk about, you know, the Nephilim and coming to the daughters of men, and they had hybrid kids, which were giants and pretty ferocious. So if it turns out these are hybrids, we're probably going to hear a whole lot from that sector of the genre that these are the kids of the Nephilim.
Well, exactly, and actually I can't mention his name, but there is an author from Los Angeles who is bringing a film crew down here in February for 10 days. He's authored 5 books about the Nephilim, and he definitely wants to film a documentary in high definition about my findings in Paracas and the area. He thinks there's a definite connection with the Nephilim.
What do you think?
I think it's entirely possible. The interesting thing is that he's done so much research on this that, according to him, there was a major Nephilim presence on the planet about 2,600 years ago in the Middle East. And so when I had a very long, extensive conversation with him, the 3 carbon-14 tests that we have been able to establish show that 3 individuals of the Paracas culture existed 2,300 years ago.
And so, all right, we have to step away for a break for just a moment. I want to pick up there when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Brian Forrester, speaking to us from Paracas, Peru. Now, not to be confused with Caracas. That's a different place entirely. This is Paracas, Peru. Brian, while we're on that, before we get back to our discussion, tell us a little bit about Paracas. How big a place is Paracas?
Paracas is a population of about 1,000 people. It started out as more or less a holiday place for rich people from Lima, the capital, in the 1950s, and gradually it's becoming an international tourist destination. It's right by the ocean, beautiful desert weather, very constant, wonderful temperature. It's cool in the morning, cool in the evening, and very nice and sunny 365 days a year. So it's a great place to live. And it's far enough away from the big, you know, the big city of Lima, which is a population of 10 million and, you know, utter chaos, to this very quiet, seaside town. Mm-hmm. is one of the reasons I've been spending a lot of time here, but it's mainly the ancient culture that's more or less fixed me in this place.
I'm headed somewhere with this, but let me ask you, we can see your surroundings. We can see you're in a very nice modern room. Are you in a home or a motel?
Actually, I'm staying in a hotel because I'm the tour leader of a big group of people right now from the U.S., England, and Australia. We're studying the ancient megalithic sites of Peru, Bolivia, and then we're going to Easter Island in a couple of weeks. So we just came from Nazca, where the famous Nazca lines are today, and we're heading to Cusco in the next couple of days. So it's just a little stop in order to show the elongated skulls to my guests, and also a chance for me to, you know, just have a look around this area.
So how long you're going to be in Paracas? What, one day, 2 days?
Yeah, basically just until tomorrow.
Till tomorrow. Okay, here's where I was headed with that. You obviously have access to very modern technology where you are, because you're speaking to us via Skype. Those who are watching our TV channel are seeing you via Skype. So you've got good, reliable electricity. You've got a good internet signal. But you're located really right in the middle of, you just a few feet outside your door, I guess, you get into pretty rugged conditions, pretty primitive, I would think, where these skeletons are found, right?
Yeah, it's really, it's not just desert, this is extreme desert. The Paracas area gets about an inch of rainfall per year. So where you don't find water, there is nothing but sand. But the good thing about that is that that's why these skulls and skeletons and other artifacts have been perfectly preserved for 2,000 plus years.
When you get up at the other place near Cusco, and you have to go out to, I think you said there's a farm or some land where these 7-foot skeletons have been found. You're going out into an area that, compared to where you are right at this moment, would be pretty primitive. No internet probably. Maybe no electricity. Would that be correct?
To some degree, it's a very rural area, but actually that's another advantage. That's why these, for example, these skeletons have been sitting undisturbed for so long, is because the local people don't really seem to be all that interested in them. Archaeologists actually have not been to the site where I'll be going. So that's very advantageous for me.
So when you, and there's some background to this too. I've lived where we were technologically pretty much zero. When the sun went down, you could light a candle or go to bed. I mean, that was it. No electricity, no telephones, no radio, no TV, nothing. And sometimes running water, not always. So I'm just trying in my mind, because I've lived in those conditions, I'm just trying to sort of imagine, you go out there and you're going to look at these skeletons, you don't have any modern technology with you. How will you handle that? I mean, you can't use any kind of modern measuring range. Well, I guess you could use a range finder to measure distances between places, because those are battery operated. But you don't have any modern anything to work with there. How do you handle it? Do you scoop everything up and bring it back into town, or what do you do?
Yeah, I guess we'll have to deal with that as we go. I'm going to be bringing, you know, my high-definition camera with me to record everything, the whole process. But we're going to keep the location secret because we don't want other people, obviously, to come and, A, disturb the site, B, steal evidence. And, in fact, you know, we don't really want any official people to know about what we're doing, because I've tried my very best throughout this whole process to keep away from any, you know, overly heavy paperwork if it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just creates stumbling blocks, and because we have permission from the landowner, and because it's going into an official museum, we should have no problem. But in terms of removing the skeletons, of course, we'll have to wear gloves and masks and make sure that we record location and the exact arrangement of the bones, etc. But it's a process that I'll have to get into once I have the opportunity to actually go out and do the work.
Why would you have to, there's nothing wrong with wearing masks and gloves, but why would you have to? I mean, is there some biological danger of contact with these bones?
No, but the thing is that any physical contact of a human being with old bones means that you automatically contaminate the bones. And so for DNA study, it's best to have as sterile conditions as possible so that when analysis is done, they don't have to try to separate my DNA on the surface of the material from, you know, that which is at least 2,000 years old.
How will you be able to determine that these skeletons are of people that are 7 feet tall? And here's why I ask the question. When the body decays and the muscles and flesh and connective tissues go away, there's not a skeleton laying there with the rib cage curved around and everything in place like it was. It all falls apart. And how can you tell? I mean, it may look like it's 7 feet tall, but if you put it all back together with connective tissue, it may only be 6 feet tall.
Well, that's a good point, and that's why, again, going back to the femur, that's what forensic scientists use. You know, modern day, if they find someone who's been murdered or killed or whatever, you know, a year old or 10 years old or 20 years old, they use the femur because from the femur they can estimate within, I think, 5% accuracy the overall height of the individual. And so if we have the femurs there, we can calculate how tall these people were. And again, that's why using an ankle bone or a finger or a toe doesn't work. Because, you know, with an ankle bone, somebody could simply have huge feet. Whereas with the femur, that's what U.S. forensic scientists use.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very simple calculation from the length of the femur to the overall height of the person.
All right. So have you ever come across or seen or handled one of these femurs from one? Well, I'll let you answer that when we come back. The bumper music just started and it tells me I have to shut up. So we'll be back right after this break, folks. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour. And my sincere hopes, wishes, and prayers that you never suffer that tragedy again. My guest this evening is Brian Forrester, and he is speaking to us from Paracas, Peru, and actually is leading a tour group right now, and I guess they've gone for dinner and now have headed off to bed, and he's still up working. He's still up talking to us. And I really appreciate him for taking the time to do this. And we're talking about these elongated skulls that are found, really they've been found around the world, but a lot of them right there in the area where he is, and he is associated with a history museum in Paracas. And they have, I think you said, Brian, you have five of these elongated skulls in the museum, right?
Actually, 35.
35. Okay, yeah. I don't know where I got five.
Okay. Well, five very special ones, but 35 in total.
Oh, I see. Quite a display then. All right, as we went away for break, I was asking, have you ever actually seen or handled the femur of one of these 7-foot elongated skull skeletons?
Not yet. The ones that I have from the Paracas area averaged about 6 feet 2,000 years ago, and taking into account that the average native person at that time would be about 5'2", these people would have appeared to have been giants, but the 7-foot tall ones, I'm hoping to get hands on, you know, literally hands on with within weeks or months of, or a few months of now.
Uh huh. Let me ask about the eye sockets of these elongated skulls. Do they look somewhat proportional? As similar to human, or are they? Do they look like oversized eye sockets?
They're very much oversized. I can't give you an exact amount, but a ballpark estimate would be about 20% larger than what we have. So that's a very important point. The eye sockets, on average, are much bigger than we are, or than we have.
All right. Now the skull itself, I understand it is elongated. So if we start at the top of our forehead and move upward, it goes a great distance upward, further than ours. But what about the rest of that skull? Is that skull bigger than a human skull overall? I mean, even if you were to round it off and not make it elongated, would it still be bigger than the human skull, or is it about the same size?
Well, in terms of cranial capacity, some of them are very similar to what we are, but others are 25 to 30% larger. So their brains would have been 25 to 30% larger than ours, and that's based on actual measurement. You know, some people have stated on the internet and in other places that they had brains twice as big as ours, but I've never seen measurements. I've done the measurements myself. One that I did see today in another museum, I would guess at being at least 30% larger than an average human being.
All right, we're going to open up the telephone lines, and I had not planned to do this, but we will. We have a good connection with Brian, and so that he'll be able to hear you and you'll be able to hear him. So if you have a question or a comment for Brian, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And we would love to hear from you. All right? And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. Hello, Brian. This is Kathy in Las Vegas.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I would be very curious to find out, because their teeth structure is so much different than ours, what kind of a diet would they be able to eat?
Well, based on the archaeological record, they had a better diet than we have. They had seafood, they had fruit, they had vegetables, and they possibly had wild game as well. But they had a very fully rounded diet. The Paracas area 2,000 years ago was much lusher than it is now. Now it's desert, but there was a major change in climate here 1,500 years ago. And so prior to that time, it was a very green area. It's actually the most productive ocean in the world, or ocean area in the world. So they would have had anything and as much of anything as they wanted to eat.
Even with missing the canines, I would think that would eliminate meat, or in the not having molars would have not had like as many grains as we do. So that they're primarily ocean eaters.
I think predominantly, and that's what we find in the archaeological record, incredible volumes of shellfish and fish, and also they had corn and beans. That probably was their primary diet.
That's very cool. Because you can learn a lot about a culture by what they eat.
Oh, definitely.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks
Pleasure.
For the call. 623-444-5889. Have you found, or has anybody found, any of the remains of their dwellings?
Well, that's the amazing. That's a great question, because these people lived underground.
Underground.
Yeah. Yeah. There was quite a massive, you know, village of at least 1,000, if not more than 1,000 people, and they lived. They lived under the earth. They there would be a trap door in the top, and they would climb through that, and then the whole. Mainly one room structure would be underground.
So you had like 1,000 people living underground in one room.
Well, no, not in one room, but in one village. So every family or even individual would have their own house. But there, you know, it was quite a massive village of at least 1,000, if not 2,000 people.
And has that been discovered? And has it been excavated?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was excavated in the 1920s and then in the 1960s, and it's just been left to ruin now. The Peruvian government hasn't really provided any funding in the last 50 years in this area much, so because it's such an exposed area of desert, the wind blows quite heavily a lot of the time, which could be one of the reasons they lived underground. And so the wind has blown the sand, and all the excavation that was done to uncover this subterranean village has been completely covered back over again.
Wow. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Glinda from Houston.
Hello, Glinda from Houston. What's on your mind this evening?
Yeah, Brian, you mentioned some German studies that have been done. I'm just curious to know why universities all over the world aren't jumping on this and funding it and trying to get involved. You seem to be an independent, but what about the university anthropology departments here and there?
Well, that's an absolutely excellent question. And the thing is that there seems to be almost brainwashing in the idea that all of this was cranial deformation, it was ceremonial, so nobody's really looked at it. Maybe because I'm an independent researcher, that's why I've really moved into it in such a big way, because I don't have a preconceived notion of anything. And that's why I've been looking at the obvious, you know, examples of cranial deformation and head binding and stuff. But there are these few individuals that we have examples of where the shape of the head is so complicated that there's no real way that you could bind the skull to make it create that shape. It's just too natural looking. So I went through a long period of frustration of that. I've also gone through a long period of frustration of local or Peruvian doctors not being interested. So I'm just focusing on those people who are actually assisting me. And, you know, gradually we are moving forward. But that is one of the best questions. Why doesn't a major university spend a lot of money to study this? And I have absolutely no idea why they don't.
Well, you've run into that same wall that so many run into, and it's called status quo. But, you know, I would think if talking about, you know, the binding, and there was, that practice does exist today even, binding the heads to create sort of a cone-shaped skull. That works pretty easily if you've got the three plates. But if you've got two plates, then you've got one that goes from side to side in one form, and instead of being two plates up there, you've got one that goes across like a helmet. And that's going to be pretty hard to squeeze that into any other shape.
Yeah, exactly. And another point is the fact that we have the three finest examples we have, they're bilaterally perfectly symmetrical. So if you were going to do head binding, especially, you know, like a so-called primitive people, you're going to wind up with one side of the head looking a little bit different from the other side as you're, you know, increasing the tension on the string or whatever that's wrapped around the skull. So that's why, you know, I say these look like they were born that way, because they just look too natural.
Well, and you told us about a skeleton that you've got in the other museum up near Cusco of a child about a year old or less, and it had the elongated skull, didn't it? Already.
Well, and yeah, and the amazing thing about that one is that I've had doctors, I've had nurses, and I've had dentists look at them, and the consensus is that the baby was somewhere around a year old, maybe a little less, maybe a little older, but the teeth are what are bizarre, because it has molars, and the dentists who have looked at that individual say that the teeth are those of a 7-year-old child, whereas the skull is that of a 1-year-old. So again, I think that's where we're getting into the area of interest. If you were looking at a being that was a hybrid or something other than Homo sapiens sapiens, you would have strange characteristics like that.
The Star Child skull, and you've worked with, been affiliated with Lloyd Pye and the Star Child Project, and you've talked about that here a little bit this evening. He's at a stage now where he is saying that the DNA is showing that this is not human. It's just not human. And further, its DNA doesn't match anything else on the planet that we know. Do you suspect that you're going to get to that point with these skulls, or do you suspect you're going to get to a point where it is human but different?
It's speculation on my part, but I think we will be looking at least, if nothing else, we're looking at an ancient line of humanity that disappeared, and probably started out as a small population of very different looking people who over the course of hundreds of years interbred with normal humans, and that's probably where the skull binding came from. Once the original natural population started to disappear, they began the process of binding the skull to try to bring these ancestors back. But it is possible that we are looking at a humanoid life form which is very, very different from us.
Well, it's certainly mysterious. I don't know what to think about all of this, but I mean, they exist. That's not an issue. They exist. The skeletons are there. The skulls are there. So it's not a question of were these people here. They were, and their remains are here. But it's a great mystery as to actually who are these people. Now, here's a possibility. This is a weird possibility. You may, when you hear this, you may reach over and click the button and just turn the camera off and walk away. I don't know. But this Earth is 4.5 billion years old. History, if we go as far back as we think we know, we can get back a few million years with fossil records and so forth. So with at least that's what they speculate. We can go back a few million years. Well, a few million in the face of 4.5 billion is nothing. What we call ancient history doesn't even begin to get ancient. So, is it possible that there was an advanced, technologically advanced civilization long before us? Long, long before our ancient history. They got wiped out. However, there were some survivors, a few stragglers, that survived. And maybe, because they had been high-tech, they knew all kinds of stuff that people didn't know later on. And maybe they decided they would try to re-tech the planet. What do you think?
I think that's very possible, and even only have to look back 12,000 years. We're going to have Dr. Robert Schock with us in 2 weeks. He's the geologist who was able to date the Sphinx accurately in Egypt at being older than the pharaohs.
Right.
And so he's coming with us to Tiwanaku and Pumapunku as well as Easter Island in order to date the megalithic structures. What I've been able to do is, because I've spent so much time in the field researching in Peru, anywhere that I've found megalithic, mysterious buildings of unknown manufacture, as in they clearly weren't made by Stone Age people, you know, with stone hammers and copper chisels, anywhere you find the megaliths, you find the elongated skull. So I think what I'm looking at is I'm looking at the descendants of a lost period of history. There's mounting evidence that 12,000 years ago, our Earth was impacted heavily by either a solar outburst or a comet or something, which caused the very rapid melting of both poles and caused the axis of our Earth to shift. And that most likely destroyed most evidence of a previous highly advanced humanoid civilization on this planet. And that's why we have to this day mysterious structures in Peru, Bolivia, and Egypt that clearly were not made by inferior people. They are examples left over of a very advanced culture.
I agree with that entirely. I want to take this call, and then I want to comment on that. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin. This is Rusty from Michigan.
Hello, Rusty.
Hey, Rusty.
Hello, Brian. You know, you mentioned about that some of the people with elongated skulls may have intermarried with, you know, people of Earth, and so it just kind of, you know, that elongated skull kind of went away through, just, you know, time and whatever. Well, if some of them elongated skulls come our way, you know, like they come down to where our skull is, if they bred with humans, wouldn't some of the humans also have ended up being like the ones with elongated skulls?
Well, the thing is, I'm very fortunate in that on this tour that I'm, you know, that I'm doing, there is a retired professor of DNA study who's with us. And so when I mentioned the idea, you know, if you had this small population of people who had this specific characteristic, and over time they mixed with normal-looking people, as long as their DNA was close enough that they could breed, would it happen that this one characteristic would disappear? And he said, yeah, that would happen over time. You would lose that characteristic because the normal look and composition of a human being would start to definitely take over generations.
Well, doesn't that mean that our feature, or human beings' features, would have been changed also as a result of that mixture?
That's, yeah, well, exactly. There would definitely be characteristics, other characteristics from the elongated people that would wind up in possibly even the present-day population.
Well, is it possible that the elongated skull, here's what I'm actually getting at, is it possible that that elongated skull is the go-between between us and whatever may have bred with us?
I think so.
Whereas the original people didn't have elongated. The elongated skull is a mixture of some other being and humans.
No, I think the elongated skull is something which is the ancient ancestral thing that came, you know, that possibly came from somewhere else. And it's just that because of their population being much smaller, you know, way back in time, that characteristic gradually disappeared, and that's why the cranial deformation was done in order to try to replicate the ancient look.
All right. That's all I had. Thanks a lot.
All right,
okay,
thanks
thank you.
The call. We have a break coming up, and I want to comment about this evidence that there was a high-tech civilization that got wiped out around 12,000 years ago. I said on the show, it was either last night or night before, I was talking about the Great Pyramid, and I was talking about that whoever built that was definitely high-tech, because they built something out of great big stones that we cannot replicate with our technology today. And I've had people tell me, Brian, oh, sure we can. And here's my challenge. Then go do it. You know, you think you can build the pyramid? Go build it. You can't. We don't have the technology that it would take to build the Great Pyramid today. They were high tech. All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this.
America, and you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, like no other talk radio on earth.
You are indeed listening to The Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith. My guest this evening, Brian Forrester, joining us from Paracas, Peru. And he is affiliated actually with two different museums there. And we're talking about this whole elongated skull thing. As we went away for break, Brian, I was making the point that, you know, we have really high technology, we think, right now. But even with our technology that we've got right now, we do not have the capability of building the Great Pyramid. We could build something that size. We could build something that shape. We could not build that structure with those big blocks. We don't have the equipment and the means to do it. And I've had people tell me, well, of course we could. And my answer is simple, then go do it. Nobody's tried, because everyone that's an expert at building says we couldn't do that. It would be virtually impossible. It would be impossible for us to build that. So they did it, whoever they are, and that means they had technology and abilities and skills ahead of where we are. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. If you look at some of the very basic characteristics of the Great Pyramid, you're looking at least 2,200,000 multi-ton blocks, not of limestone. Not only that, but you're also looking at the interior of that structure is made of Aswan granite. Again, multi-ton, and Aswan granite is 500 miles away from where the Great Pyramid is. It occupies the space of 13 acres, and the flatness of the ground on which the Great Pyramid was made is supposedly within 1/8 of an inch of being perfectly level. And I've heard from modern builders that a skyscraper, for example, the footprint of a skyscraper has to be within about 15 inches overall of being perfectly flat, and yet the Great Pyramid is less than an inch. The idea that some pharaoh decided to have this done out of ego is completely ridiculous, because the accuracy of construction without using mortar of that structure by itself is phenomenal. It would be phenomenal if it was done today, but the idea that it was made by some culture that suddenly appeared out of the field, literally out of the field, you know, hunter-gatherers, and constructed something of that scale is completely ridiculous.
I did an interesting study. It was interesting to me. Study of ancient Egypt, and what if you go to the period of time that they considered ancient. In other words, we have these ancient texts, and they talk about a period of time that they considered ancient. So it takes you back further. And they talk about their ancestors. And they, when they talk about their ancestors, they talk about them as being brutes, as being uncultured, uneducated, barbaric. I mean, they talk about their own ancestors in very unflattering terms. And that takes you back, those ancestors that they talk about, that takes you back almost to the time when traditional history says the pharaohs were building the pyramids. Well, there's a problem with that. There were no pharaohs at that particular time. So if you come up into pharaonic Egypt, the pyramid is demonstrably older than pharaonic Egypt. But it's even older than their oldest ancestors that they talk about. So somebody with really high technology was on this planet. I'm not sure whether they were extraterrestrial or whether they were terrestrial. I don't know. But a very high civilization. And not just high civilization, but high-tech civilization was on the planet. Now, you've got in South America, you got pyramids. There's a pyramid in South America that by volume is bigger than the Great Pyramid. It's mostly covered with trees and stuff, but by volume, it is bigger than the Great Pyramid. You got one in China bigger than the Great Pyramid. nobody's ever seen it except from the air. During World War II, a pilot shot some pictures of it from the air. But what's the deal with all these pyramids all over the world? Do you think these pyramids are related to the elongated skull people?
It could be. The thing is also that there are other structures which aren't pyramids but are made out of massive blocks. You know, that's what why we use the term megalith, which means, you know,
giant stone. Yeah.
Yeah, so for example, just above Cusco, which is the capital, or was the capital of the Inca, there's a place called Sacsayhuaman, and it's a massive wall constructed out of huge stone blocks, each one of a very different shape, but they interlock so well that in some places you can't fit a human hair in between, and some of these stones are 125 tons. And I guess I'm a bit of an expert on the Inca. I've written books about them. And in some of the ancient accounts, when the Spanish first encountered the Inca, they were, you know, blown away by this and other structures. And they said, "Did you build this?" And the Inca said, "No, this was built before our time. It was built in the time of the giants."
Did they elaborate about the time of the giants? Do we know anything about that time of the giants?
Again, we're going back to the idea of these people called the Viracocha. There's no real estimate as to when exactly they lived, but that's, again, why it's important that Dr. Robert Schock, the geologist, is coming in a couple of weeks here, because he was able to clearly date the Sphinx at being at least about 8,000 years old, whereas the pharaohs only go back about 4,500. And so I'm hoping that he'll be able, through looking at the weathering of the stone, be able to tell us or estimate how old he thinks some of these are. And my personal belief is that some of these are at least 12,000 years old.
Here at this show, we have an associate host. When I can't be here at the microphone, then the associate host is the host. And his name is Jerry Wills. I don't know if you're familiar with Jerry, but Jerry.
I know Jerry.
Okay. Well, Jerry, of course, Jerry is kind of a giant himself. You know, he's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty tall. He's done a lot of work. Down in Peru, he's, you know, and one of the things he's told us about is a place, boy, I wish I could remember the name of this canyon or valley, but anyway, up in the mountains at, you know, 12,000, 13,000 feet, they have found like sandbars. It looks like a beach with all kinds of seashells and sea life remnants all up there. And in that particular place, I think the local legend is that that was all inundated at one time. And so water was up that high. Do you know anything about all of this? Because in that same valley, there are several so-called lost cities of giants that he's been into and is actually has some pretty great stories about what he found there. But do you know anything about this thing about the water levels being high and watermark being up on the Andes and stuff?
Yeah, well, I think Jerry's best known for his work at a site called Aramumuru or Amarumuru, and it's called a portal, mm-hmm. And it's at Lake Titicaca, and as you said, it is above the lake level now, and it's this massive wall of red sandstone where there is this door, which isn't really a door, it's a depression And he's done toning work there, whereby, according to him, you can enter into the stone itself, or at least your consciousness moves into it. And that site is about, I believe it's about 100 feet above the lake level now. And as we travel around Lake Titicaca, which is the second largest lake in South America, you know, 12,000 plus feet above sea level, there are other megalithic ancient structures about the same. They're about 100 feet above present-day lake level, including Tiwanaku and Pumapunku. And so basically, from what I've heard, Lake Titicaca was 100 feet higher about 10,000 years ago. And so all of these sites would have been right on the edge of the lake at that time. And I think they're all interconnected and all date back at least 10,000, 12,000, and maybe even more years prior to now.
Well, are they at 12, 13,000 feet high?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Just as a side note, I'm very familiar with what Jerry says about that doorway, and it's one of those stories that makes you raise one eyebrow and wonder. But I have interviewed other people who have been there and who were witnesses to what happened to Jerry, and I've interviewed them in my studio face-to-face, and some witnesses who themselves reproduced or duplicated what Jerry did and themselves had that weird experience of going into another dimension or something at that doorway. So I haven't experienced it, but I've talked to people who have, and I can tell you this, I don't want to be moving through a rock, because if I suddenly become conscious of something else and get out of the toning or whatever, I'm stuck in the rock. I don't want to be there. But it's very interesting and very curious, and these were very feet on the ground kind of people. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
In the area where you work, do you have any of those strange sites like Aramamuru?
Not as much here at Paracas, but I'm actually spending more time up around Cusco. And there are a number of very odd stone, not only structures, but also the faces of hills, which are solid stone, where you have something similar. You have these refrigerator-sized cubes of stone that have been removed by what technology no one seems to know. So far I've taken three engineers to many different sites, and they've tried to figure out what technology would have been involved in order to be able to remove stone.
All right, we have to step away for break, but we will be back, and when we come back, we'll pick up right there. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Brian Forrester, who is speaking to us this evening from Paracas, Peru. And, Brian, we only have a few minutes left here. We're on final approach and bringing this one in for a landing in just a few minutes. But you were talking about strange sites near Cusco, and you said there's a place, or several places, where there are these refrigerator-sized blocks of rock that have been cut out of the sides of cliffs, and we got cut off then.
Yeah, basically, and I've taken engineers there from the U.S., England, and Australia to look at them, just because they're fascinated with this. And the first question I ask is, could this have been done with the tools in the archaeological record, as in bronze chisels and stone hammers? And they all say no. And so the next question is, could we do this today? And they just look at it and say they can't figure out how it could be done to extract something in that fashion. And then my third question is, how would you, if you had, you know, the wildest imagination in the world, how would you imagine that could have been done? What kind of technology? And they all say the same. They say some kind of vibrational technology, or some kind of sonic technology that we don't presently have. So what that's telling us, I think, is that ancient people, a long way back in time, had forms of technology that we don't have. They didn't have lasers. They had some kind of vibrational way of manipulating matter.
Are you familiar with Michael Tellinger?
Yes.
Michael Tellinger talks about a site somewhere there in Africa, where they have found remains of what he thinks is, in fact, that vibrational technology, including how they focused the sound waves, in much the way that you would focus light with a laser. They were focusing sound waves and using it as energy to do work. And he's come across the ruins of what he thinks is, you know, that technology. And he might be right. I don't know. But you're the second person that I've heard talk about this sound technology in that way. I mean, lots of people talk about they used sound for healing and they use sound for this and that. But you're the second one I've heard talk about using it for big construction, cutting huge blocks of stone. In Egypt, when they cut those huge blocks of stone of granite at the Aswan Quarry, they know that's where it came from. How do you think they moved it? And the reason I'm asking, in South America, you have the same thing. You have big blocks of stone that were cut from a quarry three mountains away or five mountains away, and here it is over here on this one on top of a mountain. How do they move that?
Well, that's a great question. And I think from, you know, theoretical physicists and people I've been talking to, the concept is not anti-gravity. The concept is neutralizing gravity. So it's using vibration to be able to neutralize gravity to make any object, it doesn't matter what size or shape, make it weightless. So it's not the idea that you can make them necessarily float or fly, but by neutralizing gravity, it makes something the size of an automobile about as difficult to move as the equivalent made out of styrofoam. So it wouldn't require too much effort. And taking into account, of course, the fact that at Aswan, again, it's 500 miles away from the Great Pyramid, and you've got a sandy desert in between, there's no way they could roll that on logs or something like that. So they would have had to have had some kind of technology to be able to neutralize gravity and make the material essentially weightless.
Do you think that technology still exists and may be found?
I think actually it's being refound, because I'm fortunate in that next month I'll be guiding another engineer from the United States down here, and he's working theoretically on the concept of being able to work with vibrational technology for future construction. So that's why he wants to see the ancient examples so that he can compare that with what he's thinking of in terms of actual industrial technology utilizing vibration and sound to build buildings and shape materials.
Well, I think that will be a fantastic thing if he is able to do that, if he's able to rediscover how that happens. But what about the remnants of this technology? We see the remnants of the results of the technology. The Great Pyramid is, that's a result. What about remnants of the technology itself?
Well, that's the biggest thing that skeptics have used. They say, where are the machines? And people like, I don't know if you've interviewed Stephen Mailer, who's an oral tradition specialist of ancient Egypt, but also Christopher Dunn, who wrote the book The Giza Power Plant.
Mm-hmm.
But they and others have found very fascinating objects in the Cairo Museum, which seem to be components of machines, but they have been mislabeled. That, for example, there are these amazing, beautiful circular discs or dishes with fins on them, made out of incredibly hard stone material. They've been labeled as fruit plates, but in fact they look like impellers or components of machines that would run at incredibly high speed. But I think the simplest thing is that any ancient technology that would have been left behind by an advanced civilization, once that civilization disappears and you have more primitive people moving into the area, anything of fascination would have been immediately taken apart, especially if they contained crystals or gold or silver components. And so the evidence would have been scattered, literally scattered to the four winds.
Well, I want to thank you, Brian Forrester, for being with us this evening and for taking time out of your busy schedule, staying up later after leading a tour group all day, and got to do it again tomorrow. But thanks very much. We appreciate it. And if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Brian Forrester, and speaking to us from Paracas, Peru, and what fascinating stuff he's associated with. I'm very anxious to hear the result of the DNA testing that is about to begin on these elongated skulls. And so I hope when the results begin to come back, I hope Brian will come back and talk to us again and share with us what they have discovered. That's going to pretty much wrap it up for this evening, folks. Remember this. Remember, if you're not subscribed to the K-Files, you won't get it. And nobody but you can fix that. So get over there and subscribe before we start sending out this week's K-Files. That's going to happen within the next hour or so. We'll begin. So subscribe and activate your subscription. If you're not a member, join. Nobody but you can fix that. And then you have access to all the goodies. All right, that's going to do it for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.